You are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting from the coast of California on July 5, 2015. This evening's podcast will focus on questions posed by those who follow our Facebook and website pages. We receive a lot of inquiries at Pituitary World News and decided to share some of those questions with all of you because the topics are obviously relevant and apply to a number of people who have similar illnesses and situations to those who have posed us those questions over time. We always try to respond individually and will continue to do so, but this is a way of sharing with the whole class, if you will. So let's get started. The first question is, why is it that some patients seem to crash and end up in the emergency room regularly, yet my daughter has zero cortisol and takes a replacement and has never had a crash? In fact, that's a very good question. Central adrenocortical insufficiency is differentiated from primary adrenocortical insufficiency in that the pituitary control over the adrenals is responsible for sex steroid and cortisol production. The adrenal gland is actually several glands rolled into one, and the outer rim of the adrenal gland makes aldosterone, and that is produced in response to plasma, renin, angiotensin, aldosterone axis, which is a very complex system that is regulated by blood pressure, blood volume, serum potassium levels, etc. Adrenal crisis, or the crash that's been asked about, is more common in patients who have primary adrenal insufficiency because they also lose aldosterone, and they're more likely to end up with severe volume depletion, hyponatremia, and hyperkalemia. Adrenal insufficiency due to pituitary disease can result in what is referred to as a crash when patients are severely cortisol deficient in the setting of a flu, an illness of some type, maybe a urinary tract infection, as in one of my recent patients, some sort of injury or medical procedure. In these patients, you might see hypoglycemia and or hyponatremia. But interestingly, most patients who have pituitary disease have partial adrenal insufficiency, so it's unusual to see crashes in patients who have pituitary disease. In my recent patient, she had a meningioma of the cavernous sinus and had undergone radiation and had started developing adrenal insufficiency a couple of years after treatment. Her adrenal insufficiency actually started to progress such that when she had a couple recent procedures and also a urinary tract infection, she developed an adrenal crisis. And the hypothesis, or at least the working hypothesis that I have for her clinical presentation, is that she was developing progressive pituitary adrenal insufficiency as a consequence of her radiotherapy. She ultimately lost the ability to produce ACTH and thus had an adrenal crisis. So again, adrenal crisis or crash is rare in patients with pituitary disease, but it can be seen, and in particularly if there are significant illnesses or other stressors. The hypoglycemia that takes place in patients who have adrenal insufficiency is because cortisol is a glucocorticoid hormone. It is doing things in the body to increase blood sugar levels, and when you have a deficiency, you might end up with a low blood sugar. It also has several different things going for it that are related to sodium and fluid and electrolyte balance. It inhibits vasopressin gene transcription, and when you have cortisol deficiency, you can have SIADH or hyponatremia, and then sometimes when you take cortisol in that setting, you can actually unmask diabetes insipidus. Finally, if you have central adrenocortical insufficiency, wear your Medic Alert bracelet that says adrenal insufficiency. Maybe it should also say steroid dependent. Keep some written instructions printed maybe from our website or the National Adrenal Diseases Foundation or your physician so that you can share those with treating physicians on how to manage your steroids in the time of stress or illness. Okay, so our next question is, what are the best labs or common sense methods to monitor replacement of DDAVP and also fluid dricortisone? Now, obviously, it's unusual to take both of those medications, so we'll take care of them separately. In regards to DDAVP for diabetes insipidus, I tell patients to monitor their 24-hour urine output and try to maintain a slight amount of polyuria. Polyuria is 30 milliliters of water per kilogram of body weight, so a 70-kilogram person should have no more than about 2.1 liters of urine out per day. Periodically, I believe it's important to get the serum sodium level checked, because that would be something that you could look at to ensure that you're not being over-treated. If you allow breakthrough, however, it's unlikely that you will be in an over-treated situation. Fludrocortisone is a mineralocorticoid that replaces the aldosterone produced by the adrenal glands. Some of the pituitary patients who have had pituitary Cushing's have ultimately undergone adrenalectomy and have to take this medication. It's also used in settings where people have postural orthostatic hypotension. It's another one of those drugs that the clinical overall gestalt or picture is used in determining if the dose is appropriate. For example, too much causes hypertension and edema. Too little causes hypotension and dizziness upon standing with a rise in heart rate. The best tests, however, to monitor fludrocortisone dosage are a plasma renin level, which should be kept normal and certainly not suppressed, because if it's suppressed, that means you're holding on to too much salt and water as a consequence of the drug, and the serum potassium level, because the drug can waste potassium, and you don't want that. You want to have a normal serum potassium on this drug. Our next question is on idiopathic diabetes insipidus, and the one posing the question wondered if there's any research being done on the disease, try to understand the nature of it, and that person indicates that she had been diagnosed last year and would like to understand the cause. But idiopathic is a term that we use in medicine that basically means we don't understand the cause or the pathophysiology of the particular presentation. I used to tell patients that we were idiots about the pathology, and that's how the word came about, but that's not entirely true. One of the things I've seen throughout my career is that a number of patients with what is referred to as idiopathic diabetes insipidus will ultimately be proved to have one of the known causes of diabetes insipidus. For example, I've seen patients who have diabetes insipidus and a normal MRI scan and otherwise normal pituitary function go on to, over a couple of years, develop additional pituitary deficits and ultimately have a mass lesion in the pituitary stalk that shows up. And that could be due to a metastasis or a germ cell tumor, an infiltrative disorder like sarcoidosis or histiocytosis, for example. But ultimately, if you follow patients long enough, some of those with idiopathic diabetes insipidus are diagnosed with something that is a well-known cause of the disorder. I believe that lymphocytic hypophysitis, or particularly inflammation of the posterior pituitary gland called lymphocytic infundibuloneurohypophysitis, is probably more common than thought and may be a cause of diabetes insipidus in some patients where there is no other pituitary dysfunction and no other known cause. It's an inflammatory disorder where you have antibodies against the neurons that make vasopressin, and ultimately you take out those neurons with your immune system and you have diabetes insipidus. The other thing I'll say on this topic, it's important to see someone who knows what they're doing in regards to diagnosis and treatment. I have seen several patients come to me with the diagnosis of diabetes insipidus, having been treated with vasopressin, developed hyponatremia. When we withdraw the vasopressin and further evaluate that patient, they don't have diabetes insipidus at all. So it's important to make sure that your diagnosis is correct and seek out the evaluation and management of a pituitary-specific endocrinologist to ensure that the diagnosis is correct before you take a dangerous medication like DDAVP. One of our listeners has posed a very interesting question, or series of questions, and it is, can acromegaly angiotism be cyclical or episodic like Cushing's disease? How does excess ghrelin stimulate the pituitary to produce too much growth hormone? And what's the difference between IGF-1 and growth hormone, and why do most doctors only order the IGF-1 level? These are all good questions, so let me see what I can do with them. So first off, let me try to help you understand hormone secretion by pituitary tumors. One of the most important things to keep in mind is that it's very episodic and erratic. Patients with Cushing's who have cyclical production of hormones are extremely rare, and there's research trying to figure out precisely how common this disorder is amongst all of those who have Cushing's. But it seems to be that in those patients, the brain and the hypothalamus are somehow connected to the development of the disorder and are cyclically causing a ramp up of the disease process. To our knowledge, that does not happen in acromegaly. Ghrelin is basically a peptide hormone that is made in the hypothalamus and stimulates the pituitary. It can cause it to produce growth hormone, and this hormone basically does a number of things in the cells that cause the pituitary gland to operate the genes on DNA that leads to growth hormone production, manipulation of the protein after it's produced, ultimate packaging and secretion from the pituitary gland. Briefly, most causes of acromegaly are related to a pituitary adenoma that produces growth hormone. There are some growth hormone-releasing hormone hamartomas of the hypothalamus. Those are tumors of some of the nerve cells of the hypothalamus that can end up leading to growth hormone secretion by the pituitary. And then the most common neuroendocrine tumor that produces growth hormone-releasing hormone and causes acromegaly due to pituitary hyperplasia is that of a pancreatic islet cell tumor. And the last question, what's the difference between IGF-1 and growth hormone? Well, growth hormone is produced by the pituitary gland, and IGF-1 is a protein that's like insulin that's actually produced by the liver. We think of IGF-1 as a nice integrated marker of growth hormone secretion over time. Most people check for IGF-1 because it is an integrated marker, whereas growth hormone is secreted erratically in patients with acromegaly, so the levels can even be normal in a number of patients with the disease process and thus not helpful. We do, however, check growth hormone levels at my institution just because if you have acromegaly, we want to follow that growth hormone level, and most of the data about survivability or decreased mortality not only relate to normalization of IGF-1, but also control of growth hormone levels. So we do look at those numbers at UCSF. Growth hormone is probably most reliable in the diagnosis of acromegaly after the administration of oral glucose because glucose increases somatostatin tone in the hypothalamus and shuts down growth hormone production. Most normal people go to under 0.4, but most of us use a cutoff of 1.0 for the growth hormone. If you drop your GH to that level, that's considered to be a normal response. Another one of you asked a couple of interesting questions, and the first one and the second one are related. It's how long does it usually take to get replacement hormones adjusted from the start of the process, and how do you find most patients feel and function if they're replacing almost all hormones? How long does it take to hit a new normal? Very good questions, and it's dependent on the skill of the treating endocrinologist is the first thing that I would say. I see a lot of physicians that sort of mess around with replacement doses, and they don't understand the caveats of treatment and don't recognize how aggressive one can be. Some doctors don't even know how to estimate an appropriate dose for a patient, and they use drugs that turn out to have interactions with one another, for example, growth hormone and hydrocortisone. Growth hormone accelerates the metabolism of hydrocortisone, so you can actually start a patient who's hypopit on growth hormone, accelerate the clearance of their cortisol, and make them feel worse. So you have to use a longer-acting steroid like dexamethasone, which is not affected by growth hormone. That's just an example of one of many caveats of treatment that can ultimately determine how soon you're going to feel better after initiating hormone replacement. Probably the one thing that adds the most time to the process as sort of the rate-limiting step, if you will, is that fortunately, most of our hormones are bound to carrier proteins in the bloodstream. But unfortunately, because of that, it can take 5 to 7 half-lives of a drug to see whether a new dose is appropriate. For example, with thyroid hormone, if I start you on a dose of thyroxine, it takes about 6 to 8 weeks, some people say as much as 12 weeks, to know whether that dose is going to be appropriate. If it's not, then you have to make another dose adjustment. It's another 6 to 8 or 12 weeks, depending on the particular person. Same thing is true of sex steroids. Hydrocortisone is a bit quicker, and you can find that dose much sooner. Growth hormone takes a good 3 to 6 months sometimes, I think, to find that dose requirement. I tell most patients, give me 6 months, you know, and sometimes they're feeling better within a few weeks because we're on the road to recovery. But as far as fine-tuning and optimizing medical treatment, I think it can take anywhere from 3 to 6 months to hit it unless I nail it on the first go-round. And usually I'm pretty close on that first go-round, but I do have some patients where I have to keep stair-stepping the dose up to find the right amount. I do prefer, in the case of growth hormone, for example, and perhaps, growth hormone mostly, to start at a lower dose and work up to the lowest effective dose. With thyroid hormone, I can pretty much judge what dose a patient's going to take and get it right about 80% of the time, and then 20% of the time have to either go up or down on a dosage of medication. Steroids, it's a little easier. We use dexamethasone at UCSF, and most patients require 0.25 to 0.375 milligram daily, rarely 0.5 milligram daily. And sex steroids are just different. A lot of it in this day and age depends on what your insurance company will allow you to do with hormone replacement if you're a man. For example, whether you can use gels, patches, or have to use injections. And then women, of course, there's a lot of concern depending on other risk factors, whether you should take estrogens after menopausal age. And there are lots of different ways to take estrogens as well. So in general, the answer there is, 3 to 6 months. Most patients feel better within 3 to 6 months. And some patients come back literally saying they feel like a new person, that I've given them years back in that particular setting of treated hypopituitarism. The most important thing I can say is to be patient and work with your physician. Get your laboratory tests done. Don't ever start a medication and not have a lab test to see whether or not that dose is either too little or too much, because too much is not good either. I tell patients that doing this is like playing Goldilocks. You know, we want the medication dose to be just right. We don't want it to be too high or too low. And of course, vital to this whole process, in addition to getting the labs drawn, is see your doctor, bring up your concerns with your physician, and importantly, take your medications. You know, I'm surprised at the number of people who, despite the fact that we can talk until we're figuratively blue in the face with them, come back and they stopped their medication a month ago or two, and they feel puny, and they decided to come back in because they don't feel well. And it's simply, you know, the advice is get it back on your medications. And so what can the patient do? Take your medications, keep your appointments, get your blood draws when your physician wants them. Understand these hormone replacements, however, because one of the things that I've seen a lot of physicians will do is they'll start someone on thyroxine and they want lab studies in 2 weeks, and they're adjusting hormones and chasing their tail. And 2 weeks is not the appropriate interval. It has to be at least 6 weeks after a thyroid hormone dose adjustment to get reliable information about the adequacy of that particular dose. I had a couple of other really good questions, one of them about fertility issues in patients with pituitary tumors, and then another one addressing the long-term effects of Cushing's disease or long-term treatment and side effects of treating Cushing's with radiotherapy and adrenalectomy. And I actually have planned to do podcasts in the future on each one of those topics, so I won't address that today, but those will be coming at some point over the course of the next 6 months or so, as we're getting a lot of ideas to do new podcasts. We're trying to fit everything in. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast of Pituitary World News. Once again, Dr. Lewis Blevins, and I wish you all a good evening. Thank you.